From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Imagine working on an assembly line near Detroit for one of the big auto parts manufacturers. You earn more than $26 an hour with generous health benefits, enough to afford a middle-class lifestyle. Now imagine your salary and benefits cut in half or worse. The prospect of helping with your children's college education, gone, replaced with new worries about how to pay the monthly bills. Low-cost competition abroad has the American automotive industry reeling, with its workers paying an enormous price. And as President Bush travels to Japan, Korea, and Beijing this week, Detroit's troubles show there are no easy answers. This hour on Point, globalization, American jobs, and the future of the American wage. You can join the conversation. Do you feel threatened by globalization, or are you profiting from it? And where will the American standard of living go in a globalized economy? Where is yours going? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We turn first to Asia, where President Bush arrived yesterday in Kyoto, Japan, for an 8-day visit to the region. The White House says trade will be high on the president's agenda. Joining me now from Kyoto is Richard Wolff, senior White House correspondent for Newsweek magazine, who's traveling with the president. Richard Wolff, we know it's late there. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So tell us about the hierarchy of issues the president is carrying in his suitcase to Asia this week.
Well, first of all, he's trying to get closer to a region that he's had a problem with pretty much from the get-go, but certainly after 9/11, and certainly with the rise of China's influence in the region. So first goal is simply to bridge the gap with many of these countries. But you're right, trade is high up there. Terrorism is still up there. This is a fairly broad agenda. It takes in bird flu, too. But there's no doubt that economic issues are much higher this year than they have been in previous years.
The president turned off some leaders in Asia by his repeated insistence on the security issue above all else in some recent visits. What is on his economic plate of issues this week, Richard?
Well, very much trade. This is a pretty critical moment for the whole world trade process. There's a big ministerial meeting in Hong Kong coming up soon. Mm-hmm. They're trying to basically inject some new life into this new round of world trade talks known as the Doha Round, and that means getting into some very sensitive areas, especially agricultural subsidies. That's a problem for all of these countries, even where there's good relations. Just take Japan and America for a start, where the Japanese are still saying there's a ban on American beef because of mad cow disease. So these are emotional subjects for all of these countries, not easy by any means.
Richard, the president failed on to push free trade on his Latin American summit visit just a couple of weeks ago. Is Asia more receptive generally? Does China want free trade? And how does it cut to the U.S. benefit or not if we have more free trade with China?
Well, it's generally accepted that more free trade for all of these countries overall over the long run is a good thing. But it depends what free is. Really, when we talk about free trade, we're talking about something which is more free than what they used to be, but isn't totally free. These agreements are full of red tape and definitional issues that are an attempt to simplify trade rules. And the problem is here, not just for other countries, but also for America, there's a real reluctance to lower trade barriers on politically sensitive industries, whether it's agriculture or a car industry. Now, in China's terms, people are obviously want to trade with China. They see a very big market there. But there are real concerns, especially about intellectual property rights, not just about DVDs and music videos, but across the board, whether it's drugs, computers, it pretty much takes in everything to do with the rule of law and business in China. So this is very broad and by no means easy to fix on any side.
The U.S. running a record trade deficit globally so far this year and nearing a $150 billion trade deficit with China. Are there particular things the president may propose in Beijing that might increase the U.S. piece of trade with China?
Well, they're trying to sort of browbeat them into doing something about the Chinese currency. Anything else, American businessmen believe that it's the undervaluing of the Chinese currency that causes them problems. So, you know, again, the chances of that happening, very, very difficult as well. The Chinese have talked about social problems arising from that, the rise of joblessness. And so, you know, chances of them getting any kind of breakthrough or even forward motion on these subjects is very low. Even White House officials say they don't expect this to be about a breakthrough.
So everybody with their own agenda on what they want from globalization. Richard Wolff in Kyoto, Japan, traveling with President Bush. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Richard Wolff, senior White House correspondent for Newsweek magazine. We're talking this hour about globalization and its ongoing impact on American workers and the American wage. Joining me now from Detroit is Jeffrey McCracken, automotive reporter for The Wall Street Journal. His recent front page story was headlined, "Shifting Down, a Middle Class Made by Detroit is Now Threatened by Its Slump." Jeffrey McCracken, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
I wish you'd introduce us to a couple of people that you profiled here, Jeffrey. Chris Brown and his sister Penny Austin, their circumstances and how they're changing.
They're very interesting, and in some respects, they're very indicative of a lot of families in the auto industry here in the Midwest. Excuse me. Their father, Adrian, had worked at General Motors for 32 years, if I recall correctly, and helped both Chris and Penny get jobs at General Motors a number of years back.
Mm-hmm.
Well, those jobs later became jobs with Delphi and with Lear Corporation as GM sold off the operations.
To giant auto parts suppliers.
Correct. Mm-hmm. Delphi Corp was General Motors' parts operation up until 1999, and then GM spun it off,
mm-hmm.
and Delphi became, once it left GM, was the world's largest auto parts company. And one of the first things Delphi did was sell off one of its plants to Lear Corporation, which is another multi-billion dollar global auto supplier based here in the Michigan area.
Now, we're going to look at globalization and the impact it had on these two, but give us the details of what's happened to their compensation in the last few months or years.
Well, Penny was making $25, $26 an hour up until, I believe it was the end of 2003, when Lear, during the contract negotiations with the UAW, said, to keep this plant open, we've got to cut wages to roughly $18 an hour. So starting in early 2004, her wages dropped from $26 to $18, which $18 is still a reasonable rate for her, I'm sure, but it's difficult when you've gotten used to that higher wage. Well, now the plant is going to close. As a matter of fact, Friday, November 11th was the last day
mm-hmm.
the plant was open. She's going to have a job through the end of the year, and her only opportunity if she wants to continue working for Lear is going to be to sign up for a plant down the road that pays $12 an hour.
So that's a cut of more than half.
More than half within 2 years. And you've got to understand that above and beyond the wage cuts, people like Penny and in Chris's case as well, are also seeing their benefits cut. They're going to go from no monthly premiums to substantial monthly premiums, from very low copays on their prescription drugs to substantial copays on their prescription drugs.
Chris Brown, 47 years old, has been earning $26 an hour on the midnight shift at Delphi's fuel injector parts plant. Describe the conversation he recently had with his kids about what he's going to be able to do with them under the new Delphi deal.
Well, he's, I think, vaguely told his kids that some bitter changes are coming, but what he's not yet done, and perhaps maybe the story will get out in front of him a bit, but what he needs to do is sit down with his kids and say, I don't think I can help pay for college anymore. I want you to continue going to college, but I don't think that your wife, your mom and I are going to be able to pay for your books and pay for your tuition the way we have the past few years.
He's a union
that's
man.
That's difficult.
Yeah, very difficult. He's a union man, and the UAW has been party to this step down.
Absolutely. Well, what makes this especially difficult for Chris is, I know that there's a stereotype, if you will, of a union worker. But Chris, like a lot of union workers I talk to, has an advanced education. He went and got a bachelor's degree, and in fact is pursuing a master's now, and believes strongly in college and believes strongly in education. So I think it pains him very much to have this conversation with his kids. He's resigned, and he's okay with the fact he's going to have to get rid of a car or lose his cable TV or some of those types of things. But I think telling his kids he can't pay for college really, really breaks his heart.
And Delphi and the unions recognizing that in the face of global competition, the wage structure is going to have to change. You write, Delphi wants wages to fall from about $26 an hour to about $9 an hour. That's down in Walmart territory. And you write, Jeff McCracken, that the grand bargain between employees and employers that dates back to Henry Ford's promise of a $5 workday, which was a big deal then, paid vacations and generous health care benefits, is collapsing. You say a sizable chunk of America's Midwest is being forced to step down a rung or two on the socioeconomic ladder. How widespread is that?
It is definitely a growing trend here in the Midwest. I think form perhaps much of the country. They feel like they've been in a they've come out of the recession several years ago. But in Michigan, and I would say in Ohio as well, and in some of the areas close by, in parts of Indiana and in Ontario, across the border in Canada, there are a lot of automotive workers, whether they work for the big three directly, for GM, Ford, or Chrysler, or for the parts suppliers, that are either facing these wage crunches or just out and out losing their jobs. One of the things we found when we looked at some of the numbers that the Federal Reserve has run is that in the past, I believe, 4 or 5 years, nearly 200,000 auto parts jobs have gone or vanished just since 2000.
And you write about auto plant workers moving from the sort of $35,000 to $75,000 range of income to $15,000 to $35,000. Do workers blame this on global competition? Do they blame it on bad management at home in Detroit? How do they see it, Jeffrey?
I think the answer is yes and yes. They blame it on management. They blame it on global competition. They, I think, in Chris's case, for example, he understands globalization and he understands things are going to change. But what I think frustrates him is he feels like the company, especially the management, didn't prepare him and didn't prepare the company as well as it should have. He makes the point that In the rosy times for Delphi in 99, 2000, 2001, they could have, for example, set aside money to pay off their pensions, and perhaps that would have saved them or helped them avoid this bankruptcy scenario that they're in right now.
But now his income is crashing, so is his sister's, and as you describe it, there's really nowhere for these two right now to turn. Jeffrey McCracken with the Wall Street Journal, please stand by in Detroit. We're looking this hour at globalization and American jobs, really the American standard of living. You can join us. Do you feel threatened by globalization, or are you profiting from it? And when wages are falling by half around Detroit, can this be good? Where are we headed? 1-800-423-8255 is the number. 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about globalization and American jobs, about the American standard of living. You can join the conversation. What do you think? You've been watching for years now. Can American workers join the global labor pool and still have an American standard of living, a middle-class living? Who's profiting from globalization? And is the country taking the steps necessary to ensure all Americans ultimately profit? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've been talking this morning with Jeffrey McCracken. He covers the automotive industry for the Wall Street Journal. He's been writing very movingly and in detail about automotive workers in the Midwest really being whacked down in their standard of living. A whole chunk, a sizable chunk of the Midwest being forced to step down a rung or two, he writes, on the socioeconomic ladder. We want to get the big picture here as well. We're joined from Washington by Robert Scott. He's international economist at the Economic Policy Institute. Robert Scott, thanks for being with us today.
Hello, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Also with us from Chicago, Marvin Zonas, Professor Emeritus of Business Administration at the University of Chicago. Professor Zonas, thank you for joining us.
Nice to talk to you, sir.
So help us in here. We've been watching for a while, and we understand, we think in general, free trade is supposed to lift all boats, and then we watch what's going on in the American Midwest with the automotive industry, and now the word it may spread to telecommunications and aerospace, and the American standard of living in sizable chunks, as Jeffrey McCracken writes, dropping, and we wonder, what's going on here? The Economist magazine writes recently, Marvin Zonas, that anyone who's tired of globalization is tired of life. But what about our standard of living in this race? How's it doing?
Well, you know, the American economy has been growing robustly for many years, driven to no small extent by globalization. So it has lifted all boats in the sense of lifted the boat, which is the American economy. There are, at the same time, big losers. And Jeffrey McCracken just talked about some big losers, the workers in the American automobile industry. So there's no question that while all of us collectively are winners, there are some people paying very high price for this.
How have the benefits been shared around so far, in your view, Marvin Zonas? I mean, the American economy is a great big beast, and we know people get very different shares of it. Is this working for American workers?
Well, all I know is that the American public as a whole can afford to buy some high-quality, low-cost cars, for example, which we import from Japan. We can afford to buy lots of goods from China that get sold in Walmart for very low prices, and that helps everybody's standard of living.
And if we buy more and more of those cars from Japan or Korea or one day soon China, will we still have the bucks on hand to support that standard of living?
I think that the question of whether or not, by the way, people have benefited differentially is a crucial question, but it's not because of globalization. There's no question that inequality in America, inequality of income, has increased. The poor are getting richer, but they're not getting as rich as fast as the rich are getting richer. But that has to do with all kinds of public policy, including taxation, which is not the problem of globalization.
Robert Scott, join us here. We're reading Jeffrey McCracken's story. It's moving. You can see how hard it is for people who spent a lifetime in well-paying jobs to suddenly be making $9 an hour. At the same time, Marvin Zonis points out the U.S. economy has been growing briskly lately. The poor are, even the poor, he says, are getting richer. We know your group, Economic Policy Institute, is funded in part by labor unions, but how do you see what's going on here?
Well, I think that, in fact, what's happened is that working people have seen a decline in their standard of living. The real wages of working people have been falling for the last year, in particular. We've seen growing levels of poverty in our economy. I think we have to be careful to distinguish between growth of the economy in terms of GDP as a usual standard measure and growth in wages for workers, especially production workers. We've had a tremendous growth in the number of workers in this country. Immigration has been at very high levels, both legal and illegal. So output per person hasn't been rising as fast as the growth in the overall economy. Economists like to talk about how fast the economy is growing. You can't eat GDP, as some of us like to say. You live on your real wages. And if wages are going down faster than prices, as has been the case.
Is that the case now?
That is the case now. It has been the case for the past year. All those cheap goods from Walmart don't make up for the fact that you're losing your paycheck. It's certainly going to be the case for these workers at Delphi who are seeing their wages fall by 50% or more.
So what's your solution here? If real wages are falling, globalization is surging ahead. There seems to be no stopping it, even if a union or an individual would like to. What are you proposing, Robert Scott?
Well, two things. We have to recognize that there are different ways to globalize. We have been following a set of rules that are essentially written of, by, and for multinational companies. It has made the world safe for those companies to invest, has encouraged them to move plants abroad. It has done nothing to preserve the essential backbone of social regulations that we had in this country, the Fair Labor Standards Act, the Social Security Act. These are national institutions that we put in place to buffer the worst parts of corporate abuse, and firms have used globalization to get around those fundamental institutions.
But practically, what do you do? Do you put a cap on profits that multinationals make by moving business abroad and somehow funnel that to American workers? It doesn't sound practicable.
Absolutely not. I think you have to redesign the rules of the game so companies have an incentive to invest here. I think that there's two ways to do that. I think you have to first get the prices right. We've let the U.S. dollar become completely uncompetitive. It's been, in fact, talked up by some Treasury secretaries. It's been a problem not just for this administration, but for the Clinton administration, too. The dollar needs to fall by at least 40 or 50% in value. That will make our exports more competitive. It will let us sell more to the rest of the world. It will create more good jobs for U.S. workers. I think that's the first thing we have to do. Secondly, we have to encourage living standards in some of the poor countries we trade with to grow so that they can afford to buy the products that we do produce.
Of course, a lot of that depends on free trade, which selling stuff back to the U.S., things that will be made there, not here.
Well, that's been the claim, and that's been the idea for the past 20, 25 years coming out of Washington. And the problem with that is that it's kind of like the problem in the Prairie Home Companion. You know, not all kids can be above average. Not all countries can export endlessly to the U.S. There's a limit to the amount of goods that we can absorb to the rest of the world, and we've reached that limit now.
Jeffrey McCracken, give us your kind of on-the-ground view from Detroit and the Midwest there. You talk about this sizable chunk of the population being forced down a rung or two on the economic ladder. There's lots of personal pain in a small phrase like that. Do you see this big middle of America that you report on coming to grips with this effectively? Do we have the right policy to help out people like Chris Brown and Penny Austin, who you're reporting about?
Two things I'll say to that. One is that I did an extended interview with Steve Miller, who who is the new CEO at Delphi.
Mm-hmm.
And he's been embraced, I would say, by the business community for his blunt talk and his frank ways, if you will, of saying that we've got to bring our labor rates down. He's been vilified, on the other hand, in the labor community for those same statements. And in our interview, Steve said, you know, he expressed some great remorse, if you will, for people like Chris Brown, who, as he said, you know, they played fair, they played by the rules, they thought they would be taken care of because they were told they would be taken care of both by their union and by their management, by their company. And so I said to him, what's the solution? What can Delphi do?
Yeah.
And he basically said, listen, we can't, you know, no one business, no one industry can do anything about this. Globalization is a reality. It's going to come along. It's like trying to stop the wind. And there's going to be casualties along the way, and we need to put some things in place to help these people that are the casualties. As Mr. Zone has said, there's a sense of a rising tide, if you will, but there are people left behind, people drowned, if you will, by that tide. And I think the question is, who or what is going to step in and either train these people or help these people or whatever word you want to use, prepare these people for the next jobs when you know, the fuel injector jobs or the fastener jobs or the building engine jobs, when those go away, when companies decide it's cheaper to build that in Eastern Europe or China or India or Brazil, someone, I would presume, needs to step in and prepare them for the next jobs.
Do you see that happening all around you, Jeffrey McCracken?
Unfortunately, I don't. There are some state programs. I know, for example, here in Michigan, I know that the companies, with the union's insistence, do usually seem to train the workers or try to train the workers. But I don't get the sense that it's really for the jobs of the 21st century. In my conversation with Penny Austin, she said that she had talked with some training programs at the UAW, some people in the training programs the UAW had in place, and they were talking about training her for telemarketing jobs. And I believe it was cut out of the story, but she laughed. She said, "I could get a telemarketing job, but aren't those going to India as well?"
Yeah,
and you have to empathize for someone like Penny, who's being they're training her for another job that may just as well be taken away from her down the road.
She laughed at that moment, but as I read your story, she seemed to cry through most of the interview. Marvin Zonas, Robert Scott, Jeffrey McCracken, stand by. I want to begin to bring our callers into this conversation, if I may. Carol is calling from Waterloo, Iowa. Hi, Carol. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
It's more of a comment or observation than it is anything
mm-hmm.
else.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a full-time student, parent. I remain in the insurance industry on a part-time basis. And I guess, you know, I can comment definitely about the cascading effect. If nothing else, it just seems to me it's become a pyramid structure where companies like the Walmarts of the world are the only ones that are benefiting, because the John Deere and some of the bigger companies that were in this area of the Midwest, they're dwindling down to bare minimum because most of their people have gone to overseas. Even when we do get calls at home, as you just commented, mm-hmm. those calls from credit card companies are coming from overseas. I'm not seeing anything here but a dwindling income, a downtown that is dwindling down. We do have a lot of immigrant workers. And as an insurance employee, what I observe is an increase in things like workers' comp claims because people have no other place to get their benefits.
So
if you are working, you're not having any benefits. I, for one, have to purchase mine through the university.
Yep.
So I don't know. To me, it just seems like it's become a pyramid structure. There are people benefiting, but it's not the Americans. It's maybe, you know, Walmarts and people like that that can go overseas.
Yeah, we hear it, Carol, right on the front lines there in what was John Deere territory. Marvin Zonas, first of all, on the real wage front, you're describing the growing economy, and we see it, 3.8%, I think, pretty good growth recently. Robert Scott says, well, but real wages are falling. Does that mean that we haven't figured out how to share the pain properly here?
Well, a couple of points. First is that real wages have been falling, as your other guest pointed out, for only a year. So if you look over a longer period of time, it's been very positive. Let me just give you a quick statistic.
Mm-hmm.
In 20 years, the American steel industry increased steel production in the United States
right.
from 75 million tons to 102 million tons. But in the same period, while we were going up more than 25 million tons in output, the number of workers fell from 450,000 to 163,000 in the steel industry.
Mm-hmm.
So that is the good news. The good news is that we're becoming more productive. We can produce more goods and services, which we do. The challenge is, what do we do with those people who lost their jobs in the steel industry? Well, there are a couple of things. One is their kids certainly not look for their futures in the steel industry.
Right.
and the union leaders and the automobile leaders made promises to people that they should never have made, and as if globalization was not already known about. The second thing is, those guys who lost their jobs, if they can't find higher-paying jobs or jobs that paid them a living wage, and they do have to work for low wages, they should be taken care of by the government. We've cut taxes so low and we're cutting social programs so high that we don't have the resources to do that, which is outrageous.
Let me ask you, Marvin Zonis, you mentioned the management's promises that were negotiated in good faith, contracts about health care and all the rest, retirements that they now cannot deliver on. And they're essentially walking away from those. Should that be permitted? I mean, should that come out of somebody else's pocket, maybe the investor's pocket?
It certainly should come out of the investors and the managers, and I think the increases, for example, in the wages of senior executives in these companies is outrageous given the pain which workers are having to bear. Yes, the investors should come out of their pocket and not the American taxpayers as a whole.
Do you think the American standard of living is going to hold up over time with the globalization wave sweeping over the whole planet here, Marvin Zonis?
No question that the standard of living is not only going to hold up, but is going to increase as it has for the last 50 years as globalization has taken root, as the Japanese, for example, got phenomenally richer. We're much richer now than we were when the Japanese were poorer because the Japanese got richer. But in the interim, they're going to be big winners and big losers, and a lot of people in the automobile industry are going to lose their jobs. Terrible story for them.
Robert Scott, do you have that same confidence long-term that the American standard of living is going to hold up with under globalization? Marvin Zonis says proof is in the pudding. It is, and it will continue to. Do you see it that way?
I'm very concerned, and really the question is who is going to be the winner and who is going to be the loser. We're not just talking about a few hundred thousand auto workers here. We're talking about production workers, people that generally don't have a college degree, and at this point that makes up about three-quarters of the labor force. Those workers have seen stagnant wages. Real wages have been stagnant for those workers since about 1979. Yet productivity, as the speaker acknowledges, has soared.
I want to clarify this. Marvin Zonis says it's just in the last year that real wages have fallen, that they did well before that. What's the contradiction here?
Well, I'm talking, there was two things. First of all real wages for production workers did fall in the last year. They've essentially been stagnant since 1979. It's two different questions. They went up and down, but they were essentially stagnant since 79.
Mm-hmm.
But output per worker is probably 50% higher. We've broken that link between productivity and wages. What's happened is most of the benefits of growth have gone to the top 10, 20, 30% of the labor force. So we get a huge increase in inequality. And my concern is that in the future we're going to see a downturn in those wages that's going to be sustained, and the number of workers exposed is going to go up. It's not going to just be production workers and auto parts. It's going to be people who are engaged in all kinds of knowledge-based activity that's now being offshore to India and the Philippines and elsewhere.
So you see an America with, what, nice, well-heeled suburbs around the big cities that are doing well and a lot of working-class Americans sinking?
That's right. And it's not just working-class Americans. It's people now with a basic college degree that see their livelihoods being threatened. Some studies have suggested as many as 25 or 30 million additional workers could be threatened with pressure from abroad. And I think it's important to understand, it's not just the few people who lose jobs. Those 25 or 30 million workers will see their wages stagnate or fall because of the threat of foreign competition. That's the big question. It's not just those few who lose their jobs. It's everybody who suffers.
Jeffrey McCracken, what about the children of Chris Brown and Penny Austin? Where are they looking? Are they hopeful? Are they up for the fight, up for the global competition?
The one thing I will say is none of them are looking to go into the auto industry. He has four children, one of whom has graduated from college, and he's a chef.
Mm-hmm.
I believe another one is she's trying to become a veterinarian. Third one is in general studies, so not clear yet where he's going. And then the fourth is looking in computer engineering. But again, as Chris had commented, I worry about engineering because I've read that General Motors and other companies are trying to offshore that work, which is true. GM and Ford and others, I don't think, would fight you on that thought. GM, in the last couple of years, opened an engineering center in Bangalore with the idea of having folks over there doing some of the same engineering that previously was done here in Warren and cities around the suburbs around Metro Detroit.
It sounds like a field that should be perfect to study, but maybe it's not. Jeffrey McCracken, Robert Scott, Marvin Zonis, please stand by. We're talking about globalization and American jobs, the American wage. We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at Bicon.com, B-I-C-O-N.com, and Private Wealth Management at Babson Capital. For more than 60 years, helping clients build and preserve wealth through financial planning, investment management, and trust services. In Cambridge and on the web at BabsonCapital.com.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about globalization, American jobs, and the American wage. You can join us. If thousands of workers won't earn a good middle-class living in auto plants, where will they earn it? And how do we fully and fairly step up to the challenge of globalization? We're at 1-800-423-8255. We've been joined by Marvin Zonis at the University of Chicago, Robert Scott at the Economic Policy Institute in Washington, and Jeffrey McCracken of the Wall Street Journal, their automotive reporter, who's been looking very closely at just where the rubber's been meeting the road in the Midwest, and it's been pretty tough, talking about wages going from $26 an hour to maybe $9. Try that on. Muncie is calling from Washington, D.C. Hi, Muncie. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm president of a small company that I founded several years ago that makes literary gifts for the bookstore market.
Good for you.
And we started out with paper products like bookmarks and note cards, which we were very easily made in the U.S. at competitive prices.
Yep.
When we started taking our products and images of caricatures of famous authors around to the major book chains, we were told basically if you want to do mugs and things like that, you're going to have to go to China. And they said, here are the economics. We'll pay you $2.65 for a mug that we're going to sell for $7.95. It's up to you to get it produced and make a profit being given $2.65.
And there's only one way to do that, effectively.
That's China. And it really is. And you know, the prices in China for a comparable mug versus the U.S. For a four-color mug that's, say, 16 ounces of high-quality ceramic, in China is going to be about 90 cents or a buck at most.
So there's the China price driving things. How much here, Muncie?
Well, in the U.S., about $3 to $4 from the manufacturer. So there's no way that you can sell to a company like Barnes & Noble if you, in fact, want to produce your products in the U.S.
Because that China price is out there. But let me ask you, Muncie, in the year 2005, should American workers in a global economy be standing around making coffee mugs?
Well, you know, I don't know what the answer to that is, Tom, but I can tell you this. They say all boats are rising, but I think that's averagely. I'm not sure that workers in this country are going to make out all that well. I think that there's many situations like the automotive industry, like the engineering industry, like the telemarketing industry, like the consumer products industry, where there are simply no more jobs left in this country, and there won't be any.
Muncie, we've got it. We thank you for your frontline report there. Robert Scott, what do you make of this story? Should we be making coffee mugs in this country in this century? Can we afford to do that? How do you respond?
Well, I think that we need to be producing something. I think there has been really a nearly criminal neglect of the problem of U.S. competitiveness. The Reagan administration faced a problem with surging imports, massive trade deficits in the 1980s. They recognized that they had to take a step, and they got together with the rest of the large countries, the G7, and negotiated an agreement to bring down the value of a dollar, made U.S. goods more competitive on world markets. Our exports to the rest of the world soared, and our trade deficit went away. We didn't necessarily produce coffee mugs. We made high-value things like jet engines. Getting the prices right will let us do that.
So are you saying that politically the U.S. government is no longer honestly as interested in defending the working guy and gal?
That's right. And it's not just the working guy and gal. It's really the national interest in producing things in this country. We've forgotten about that. And we've ignored a critical problem that threatens to bring the whole economy down. We can't sustain the borrowing needed to pay for these trade deficits forever. They just keep getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And at some point, the house of cards is going to collapse. So it's really completely irresponsible to ignore this problem.
Marvin Zonis, please.
I'm trying to jump in.
Yes, please.
I agree with Robert on a whole bunch of points.
Yes.
That should be clear.
Mm-hmm.
There are several problems here. One is, as Robert mentions, that the government of the United States does not pay attention, in my judgment, to the importance of competitiveness. Just to give you one example, one of the reasons American businesses are having such a hard time is because the cost of energy in this country is huge.
Mm-hmm.
The reason energy is so expensive is we don't have an energy policy, and we only focus on supply, and there's just not enough natural gas. There's not enough nuclear power generating electricity.
But is the cost here higher than elsewhere? We thought Americans had cheap.
The cost is higher than elsewhere.
Really?
Because, for example, we haven't built terminals to import LNG,
mm-hmm.
which would bring the cost of natural gas down from about $13 per million BTUs down to about $5, and everybody recognizes that. So businesses are up against a wall because of these energy costs. That's only one area. The taxation policy is another area. The third is, as he said, we're running these phenomenal trade deficits, so we don't have to worry about it. If you just wait a while, the whole thing's going to crash.
Well, that's easy to say and hard to live through, Marvin Zonis.
That's why we ought to have some public policy that deals with reality rather than just letting it run on as it's running on, and it's going to the adjustment will be very painful. It will be an adjustment.
Well, here's what we're pushing to get to, and I'm glad you take us there. I mean, you're saying globalization is a fact. We have to live with it. But you're not saying that we're managing it right. You're not saying we're minimizing the pain. In fact, you're saying there's a whole lot more coming. That's what Robert Scott is talking about, in a way, a house of cards that could fall here.
That's exactly what I'm saying. And the reality is we don't want to end globalization. That would really lead to a plummet in our well-being, but we want to manage it much more effectively than we've managed it now, and Robert's been saying that. He started off with that point.
If I may, just a moment, I want to get one more question here from your corner to Marvin Zonis, Robert Scott. On the dollar, Marvin Zonis, do you agree with Robert Scott that this is the place to put American effort, that the dollar should be driven down? You've got Charles Schumer, who's talking about a 27.5% tariff on Chinese imports unless they push the Chinese currency down by that amount. Is this where President Bush should be training his fire? Marvin Zonis, are you there?
Yes. I'm sorry. I think that anything like the imposition of new tariffs would lead to a trade war. It's important to go back to the Great Depression, 1929, 1932, when we had the most severe collapse of our economy in our own history. And the reason that occurred was because we, the United States, imposed tariffs, which were the highest in the history of the world, on imported goods to try to bring jobs into the United States. It was called the Smoot-Hawley tariff, and it was a failure, and we can't do that again.
So what do you suggest? We don't want to sit around until things fall down here, and more Chris Browns and more Penny Austins and a lot more are made, even if some Americans are doing very well in the process. What do we do?
We're going to have to do things like increase the incentives for foreign companies to establish plants in the United States, retrain American workers, provide benefits for the workers who lose their jobs. But most importantly, we've got to do something about the education system in the United States. And there are large percentages of our population who are not benefiting from education and the possibilities which that would then lead them into higher paying jobs.
Because they're just not in a position to compete. Robert Scott, are you worried about bringing on another depression with tariffs and protectionism? Is that in your kit bag?
I am absolutely not a protectionist. I'm for an intelligent trade policy, an intelligent set of competition policies. I think Marvin mentions energy. It's critical that we get on top of the energy issue and invest there and develop new technologies to help us become more efficient and more competitive. On the question of currency with China, it's not getting the Chinese to force their currency down. They have been intervening to distort the currency value, to depress the value of their yuan, and that makes their goods artificially cheap. We simply have to tell them they can't keep playing the game and breaking the rules. And if we get them to do that, other countries will raise the value of their currencies as well, and that will make our goods more competitive. Secondly, I don't think we can afford to wait to retrain three-quarters of the American labor force. People in their 40s and 50s, it's going to be very difficult to give them new skills. We have to aggressively develop new programs that are going to put people back to work producing goods that can sustain high wages. Mm-hmm. And getting the dollar right is the first and probably most important thing to do, but there's more we can do.
And then there's management. Jeffrey McCracken, your paper's writing recently, even as we see these cutbacks in the American automotive industry, about Toyota looking to maybe open up an auto plant in Michigan. Now, how is it that Toyota can be opening a new plant while American automotive companies are cutting back so drastically?
If you look back, probably in the early 1990s, the big three, the traditional Detroit automakers of GM, Chrysler, and Ford, had roughly 75, maybe even 80% of the U.S. market. That number is down probably at 55, 54%. And most of that loss has gone directly to companies like Toyota, like Honda, like Hyundai.
Is that American workers' fault? Why did that happen?
I think that's a show in and of itself. I would say there are probably several factors. One is the U.S. automakers have higher costs. Their labor rates. It's not so much the wage to wage comparison between a Toyota worker mm-hmm. and, for example, a GM worker. It's the legacy costs. It's the pensions. It's all the retirees. GM, for example, has, I believe, three retirees for every worker. So you've got all these folks that the average worker is being asked to pay for, if you will.
Is Toyota going to pay less if it opens up in Michigan near Detroit?
Oh, I'm sure that the wages will be an exact mirror will be exactly the same of what a UAW GM worker would get. Again, it goes back to the health care plans. It goes back to defined benefit versus defined contribution. Toyota mm-hmm. doesn't have an onerous pension plan that GM, Ford, and Chrysler had promised workers since the 40s or 50s. They just do a 401k, so they don't have that burden, all those billions of dollars that they have to account for. If I may add, GM has a pension fund of roughly $80 billion, mm-hmm. and it's underfunded by billions of dollars. And on top of that, there is something called OPEB, which is their other post-employment benefits that they're also are on the hook for, and that's, I don't know, $40, $50 billion off the top of my head, and they only have a few billion dollars set aside for that.
But what about American management, Detroit's management? What's their liability in all this? I mean, did it have to come to this bad a pass? Could this have been managed more effectively so that the American economy and these American workers would be better off at this point?
No, I think that if you were to put some truth serum in American managers, especially retired U.S. managers that were involved in labor relations, they would say that at least a decade ago, they should have started to deal with these problems. They had a cushion, if you will, from roughly 1994 to probably around 2002, where the U.S. consumer suddenly had a thirst for SUVs mm-hmm. and pickup trucks, mm-hmm. and where the big three had perhaps 70 to 75, 80% of the total market, they had 90, 95% of the most profitable vehicles, which were the SUVs and the pickups, the Chevy Silverados and the
right.
Ford Explorers and the
Dodge Rams.
And they
could have used that but didn't to turn around?
They had a cushion. They had an opportunity, I would argue, at that time to perhaps deal with their issues. But I think the problem was that the automakers, whenever they pushed the unions would strike or the unions would resist. And the thought was, well, we need to keep the plants running because we're making so much money.
We better all hold hands and deal with this one or it could be rough out there. Chandni is calling from Cedar Falls, Iowa. Hi, Chandni. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just want to make a personal note. I heard one of your callers talking about adjustment adaptation. I'm from India originally. I've been in this country for 5 years, and right now in the Midwest region, seeing all this happen, hearing about a lot of loss of jobs, it just makes me think and go back because my dad, he's an automaker. He's a
production. In India?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
He has two factories. And, reflecting back over the years, I saw my dad constantly having to change. I mean, we had a core business, and at one point, those companies were shutting down. Those cars were not going to be manufactured anymore. So
right.
the parts that he was producing were not going to be useful. So he had to change his whole business pattern. Even though he stayed in the kind of production business, he had to evolve and he had to adapt. And he still does it today constantly.
So everybody has to adapt. But what about the wages of the workers in your dad's factories in India? What's their trend been?
The trend of it is, yes, we are more competitive in terms of getting business from outside.
So wages up?
The wages are up, but the thing is, it's very different. It's in American wages. I mean, when I look at globalization, I see it happening everywhere and having its effect. But I think it's harder for people hitting it right now, very hard, because people were not ready for it.
Well, it's also harder when your wages are going from $26 an hour to $9 instead of going up.
Yes.
We appreciate your call, Chandni. Good luck to your father in India. Let's hope this will work for all of us. Ed is calling from Niagara Falls, New York. Hi, Ed. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. How you doing? Thanks.
We're
thanks
good,
for taking
sir.
My call.
Yeah.
I just first want to preface who I am and what I'm an African American
mm-hmm.
That has over the years been engaged in small manufacturing suppliers, mainly to automotive and people like Eastman Kodak and those types of people.
And to Delphi?
Yes, and Harrison Radiators specifically.
Okay, and how's it going, Ed?
It's horrible. I'm out of business. I've been out of business. The 10 or 15 people that that I've employed over the years are, and this is some time now, it has just happened.
Mm-hmm.
But it's, what amazes me is that people are now just starting to talk about a problem that has existed since before 25 years or longer.
Yeah, we know it's been going on a long time, but it just keeps picking up speed, and we want to get a handle on it.
It's gonna, you can't.
Look, why?
First of all, let me just address the issue with African Americans, because I believe African Americans have to do that every chance they get. Okay.
Yep.
With African Americans manufacturers, we try to get into the manufacturing mainstream, into the mainstream of American life.
Right.
The government helped with programs for a while that would help us get into that mainstream, because we didn't have access to capital.
Yep.
And when we would go to capital, I actually personally sat down with bankers when I wanted to move forward with upgrading equipment, going from manual equipment to CNC equipment, computerized systems, and they sat across the desk from me and said, "Well, gee, your plan looks good, but we just haven't had that kind of dealings with African American manufacturers."
But you eventually got in, and then globalization.
We were never able, even with the local industrial development people, we were never able to access all of that to be able to take advantage.
And
of
now you're sitting on the outside looking in. Ed, our time is short. Are you going to be able to retrain and rebuild here, Ed, or what's your prospect?
No, we don't have any prospects of rebuilding. The banks in this area are out of that business. They know that the manufacturers, small manufacturers, suppliers, the companies themselves, General Motors and the rest of them themselves, were hammering us for like 10 to 12% reduction per year.
Ed, it's a hard story, and our time is short, but we wish you luck, and we're sorry to hear it's gone that way. We hope it turns around for you. Jeffrey McCracken, our time is running down here. We just get to nibble off this globalization issue. It's so big. What's the spirit that you feel in that part of the country you're in, where it's hitting hard? Where are people looking with their unease, maybe their anger, or their determination? Is there a political change coming here, or an educational change, or defeat?
I would like to say, as a lifelong Michigan resident, that there's a lot of resourcefulness, a lot of people with a can-do spirit. But I think right now there is a sense of despair. I think that's a fair statement to make in Michigan. The unemployment rate has been higher than the national average for quite some time. And there's really a feeling, I would say, in Michigan, Ohio, Indiana, that this is just the tip of the iceberg. We're only talking about the suppliers. What happens if we see a GM or a Ford or a Chrysler go down the same road that a Delphi is going down? If you were to talk to Wall Street analysts, I think most of them would say they would put in odds of 20 to 40% of one of those three, if not, you know, two or three of those three, filing for Chapter 11 in the next 2 years. And I'm not trying to predict that or anything, but that's the spirit or the sense around here, is that we might only be at the beginning of what's going to be a very, very rough period.
So watch out. If globalization is going to work, we better figure out how to do it well and to profit from it together. Jeffrey McCracken with the Wall Street Journal in Detroit, it's been great having you today. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
And Robert Scott at the Economic Policy Institute in Washington, wonderful to have you. Thank you for joining us, Mr. Scott.
Thank you for the opportunity to be here.
Our thanks also to Marvin Zonas at the University of Chicago. Listeners, you can continue the conversation at onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.